outright shock. "Is it a burger place?" I ask. He scoffs. "Is it a burger place?" He veers left toward his rust-edged truck. "I don't even know if that's a yes or a no, Miles," I say. He manually unlocks the passenger door.
"That's a get in the car, Daphne. I'm not going to dignify that with an answer."
I hoist myself into the seat, leaning over to unlock the driver's side door as Miles rounds the hood. As soon as he starts the car, The Tracks of My Tears by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles comes on full blast. A deceptively happy-sounding song about being incredibly depressed. I try and fail to swallow a laugh. Miles gives a sheepish smile.
"No idea how that got on."
"This truck is probably haunted," I agree.
"Exactly."
He pulls out along the gravel drive.
"And if the soundtrack to A Star is Born starts playing, just don't be alarmed, because the ghost likes that one too."
"This ghost gets more tragic by the second," I say.
"He's perfectly fine, thank you,"
Miles says. "Thriving?" I ask.
"Thriving," he agrees.
"Well, if he's got any tips for the rest of us," I say, "have him hit me up."
"Daphne," he says, "the first piece of advice anyone is going to give you for improving your situation is going to Big Louie's. How is it possible you've lived here for
13 months, I supply.
13 entire months, he says, "and haven't had their Petoskey fries."
"What are Petoskey fries?" I ask. He tuts.
"No wonder you're so depressed."
"Is this place in Petoskey? Are we driving an hour and a half for fries?"
"No, they're named after Petoskey stones."
"Which are?" The country road has reached a four-way stop, and he essentially pulls over to look at me.
"Daphne."
Such an air of disappointment every time you say my name.
"Was Peter keeping you locked inside a bunker?" he says.
"Just tell me about these rocks, Miles."
"They're fossilized coral," he says, like this should be obvious.
He eases off the brake, and we roll through the empty intersection. I say, "And this is connected to French fries?"
"Tenuously," Miles answers. "But they're amazing. The fries, I mean. They're slathered in cheese and jalapenos."
"Well, that explains why I've never had them," I say. "Peter isn't a big slatherer. He's more of a wheatgrass shot and lean meat after leg day kind of guy."
"What?"
Miles says, faintly amused.
"You weren't allowed to eat without Peter?"
I roll my eyes. "It wasn't about being allowed. I don't know how to cook." He does. On our second date, he'd made me dinner. Salmon and asparagus and a keto-friendly pasta salad. I would have been less impressed to learn he was an Olympian. Cooking was the one thing Mom didn't do while I was growing up. We lived on takeout and weekly nacho nights. But Peter started every day with a green smoothie and made dinner from scratch most nights. Peak domesticity as far as I was concerned. A couple months into living together, he'd tried teaching me the basics, but I always slowed things down too much, so I'd moved back to dishes duty.
"Wheatgrass."
Miles shakes his head.
"You were a gym couple too, right?"
"I mean," I say, "we were a couple with gym memberships."
"And you went together," he says, "on a regular schedule."
We did. It was one of very few silver linings to our relationship ending that I no longer felt any guilt about not going. Peter was into pretty much every form of physical exercise, but I was slower and less coordinated than him, so the few times we'd tried hiking or biking, it was more frustrating than rewarding. At the gym, we could do our own things, but still spend time together. With how busy his job kept him, that time was valuable. "We're both really organized," I say. "We did everything on a regular schedule." He gives me a look. The back of my neck prickles. "Fine, yes, we did that on a schedule too," I say.
"Nothing wrong with that," he says. "Life can get busy."
I stare at him, trying to work out if he actually believes this or if he thinks I'm hilariously boring. Maybe Peter thought it was boring too. Misreading my expression, Miles says,
"No, we didn't have a schedule, but it could have been helpful. Sometimes she and I fell into sort of living our own lives. But I'm not anti-schedule. just anti-weed grass. I accidentally snort, a little disbelieving pony. Miles's eyes narrow on a grin. I've never had wheatgrass in my life. With a knife to my throat, I'm not sure I could say what wheatgrass even is. No one could, I say. But I'm talking about the calendar.
The calendar?
Yes, the calendar. He affects a look of innocent confusion.
Could you by chance be referring to the wall-sized whiteboard where you track your paychecks, your phone calls to your mom, and your menstrual cycle?
No, I say. I'm talking about the one where I track your complete unwillingness to plan ahead and stick to a schedule, thus indicating you are anti-schedule.
I just didn't realize how important it was to you to know where I was, he teases. Should I share my phone location with you?
No, it's fine. I wouldn't want to clip your wings, tether your spirit, all that.
I'll put my stuff on the calendar, he says, if it really matters.
I shrug. It's fine. Just don't get mad if I come home while you're in the middle of entertaining a lady Oh my God, this song actually is from A Star Is Born.
Is it?
He says blandly.
Strange.
So you haven't moved on to the anger phase yet? I say. He shrugs.
I don't know if I have that phase in me.
Really? I say, surprised. I've been camped out in mine for weeks.
Getting mad never fixes anything, he says. Neither does moping. I'm not moping. I just like sad music.
Looking at him, I have to believe it. Minus a few rough days and one tense phone call I overheard through his bedroom door, Miles has seemed more or less totally fine, even cheery since the breakup, whereas I've been living in a low-grade state of constant misery. He turns off the road toward the fluorescent glow of a drive-in burger joint. On either side of the squat building, a row of parking slots nose up against menus mounted to speakers. Between the two rows, a handful of blue metal picnic tables are arranged in the cement courtyard. The place is hopping with suntanned, beach-waved teenagers sitting atop tables and queuing at the optional walk-up window. None of the food runners carrying the red plastic trays looks a day older than 17. I wonder if Peter and Scott and Petra hung out here in high school. The place has a distinctly 50s look, everything faded to suggest it's always been here, the meeting point for the hungry, drunk, and horny since time immemorial. Miles cranks his window down.
What do you want?
I'm a tourist here, I say. What do you recommend?
Chocolate cherry milkshake and Petoskey fries, he says.
I nod approval, and when the very crackly voice comes over the speaker, he orders the same thing for each of us. So what happened with the drunk guy at the bar? I ask him. He studies me for a few seconds.
Oh, him, he says when it clicks. He was just trying to order another flight, despite no longer being able to stand. Happens all the time. Just needed to defuse it.
And how did you do that? I ask.
Told him if he got into the cab we'd called for him, we'd comp his last two drinks and not ban him from the premises.
Wow, I say.
Wow what?
You laid down the law, I say, without your smile ever cracking.
Things go smoother if you don't let people get a rise out of you, he says. If you give them control over how you feel, they'll always use it.
Finally, I see your cynical side, I say. He smiles, but his jaw is tight and the smile doesn't reach his eyes.
It's not cynical. If you don't give other people responsibility for your feelings, you can have a decent relationship with most of them.
Honestly, that's not far off from thoughts I've had. Only for me, it's never been about controlling the feelings themselves. I wouldn't know where to begin with that. It's more controlling the expectations you have for certain people. If a person lets you down, it's time to reconsider what you're asking of them. In the dining courtyard, the rowdy teenagers start gathering their things, shaking their trays into the trash before piling too many people into a couple of junkers parked side by side.
A minute later, a girl in denim cutoffs and an Eat at Big Louie's shirt comes out of the burger shack with a paper bag and two paper cups, little teal outlines of Michigan printed in a patterned row around them. Miles watches my reaction to the first sip. After the initial hit of brain freeze, the taste registers, and I let out a little moan. Only then does Miles take his own sip and stuff his milkshake into the cup holder.
You know what we should do?
I don't want to sob to Bridget Jones together, I say.
At most, it was a slow trickle of tears, he objects. And that's not what I was going to say, but if you're going to just shut me down like that.
No, I grab his elbow. I'm sorry. Let's hear it. What should we do?
We should go to the beach, he says.
Isn't the beach closed after dark? I say. He squints.
Which beaches have you been going to?
I shrug. The one across from the library? With the food trucks and the ice cream pavilion and the sand volleyball courts.
That tiny little beach all the fudgies go to? He says. With the teal Adirondack chairs? That sand's probably not even local, but it's trucked in from Florida.
What's a fudgie? I ask.
Daphne, he tuts. Daphne.
Let me guess, I'm a clueless fool, I say. He starts the car.
No, just a sweet, naive, beautiful little innocent raised in captivity by a man who loves wheatgrass.
So the beach doesn't close after dark, I say. He backs out of the craggy parking space.
Not any of the good ones.
9. A fudgie, apparently, is an out-of-towner, a person who cruises north in the summer to buy fudge and use subpar beaches, then flees before autumn. It seems strange that Peter never introduced me to the term, but Miles points out that the Collinses are former fudgies themselves, having moved to their favorite vacation spot when Peter was in second grade. We drive 20 minutes through the dark before Miles pulls to the dusty shoulder of a country lane behind two parked SUVs. There's no sign of a lot, a sign, or a trailhead, just the cars and the woods. Is this private property? I ask, hopping out to follow him into the moonlit forest, bag of fries in one hand and my milkshake in the other.
It's National Lakeshore, he replies. Preserved federal land. There are better known stretches of beach around here that get crowded, but the best spots are the ones you have to be told about to find.
Oh, so it's exclusive, I joke.
Northern Michigan's hottest club.
He offers me his hand as he steps over a tree that's fallen across the makeshift path. Cherry Hill must be close behind it. I release my grip on him as I hop to the far side of the log. That place was packed.
We do pretty well all summer, he says. We're still figuring the winters out.
He casts a meaningful, sidelong look at me.
So I take a lot of side jobs in the off-season.
I feel myself blush. Stop short in a puddle of moonlight. He stills too.
That was snobby, I say. The comment about the odd jobs.
He shrugs.
You didn't mean anything by it.
I didn't. But Peter, I can now admit, definitely had. We start walking again in silence. You don't need to justify what you do for work, I clarify after a beat.
I guess I just wanted to believe Peter had good reasons to think you weren't good for Petra. Because if you were like some freeloading jerk, then Peter probably was just looking out for a friend. Instead of, you know, in love with her?
Miles says evenly.
Yeah.
My own voice wobbles. It's cooler here in the shadowed woods so close to shore. For some reason, it makes me feel all the more delicate talking about this. Too exposed now that it's just the two of us.
Hey, he bumps into me. Good riddance, right?
I say, feel really stupid. Miles stops walking.
You're not stupid.
I look at my feet, and his free hand closes over my elbow, sliding up and down my arm, rubbing warmth into it.
He told you to trust him, and that's what you did. He insists.
That's what you're supposed to be able to do with people you love. They just don't always live up to it.
Miles ducks his head to peer into my eyes, a funny grin quirking his mouth.
Do you want to get into the car and listen to Adele?
I laugh, wipe my damp eyes with the back of my forearm. No, we already agreed. That won't do any good. Might as well just see this beach, assuming there is a beach and you're not just walking me off a cliff.
Would you want me to tell you? He asks dryly. Or would that ruin the surprise?
I hate surprises.
He cracks a smile. There's a beach.
We fall back into step. The earth goes sandy as we climb. The trees thin until suddenly we reach the crest and we're overlooking the steep slope of a dune. At its foot, the dark lake rolls in on the sand, and across the expanse of beach, several bonfires blaze in the dark, several tents ringed around the most distant. The whoosh and scrape of the tide against the shore dulls the voices and laughter of the other nighttime beachgoers, and it's easy to imagine that this random group of people might be the last on Earth. Station 11-style nomads. Or maybe that we're on a different planet entirely, strangers in a strange land.
Wow, I whisper. Second best beach in town, he murmurs.
Second best? I turn. You brought me to your runner-up beach?
No one knows about the other one, he jokes. I can't just open the floodgates.
Who am I going to tell? I wave my arms out to my sides. Everyone I know is either here, my mortal enemy, or a close friend or relative of a mortal enemy.
Yeah, but your mortal enemy just cut you loose.
He gently pushes my shoulder.
Who's to say I take you to Secret Beach today and you don't bring that wheatgrass-loving asshole there next week?
I shake my head. I don't get back with exes. When someone proves who they are, that's it.
He studies me, head cocked to one side.
What? I say. You disagree?
I've only had one other ex, he says. We didn't get back together, but I'm not sure that's a personal stance.
One ex? I look back at him. How old are you?
I'm not a huge relationship guy, he says, a little bashful. Petra was the exception, not the rule for me. So if she wanted to get back together, I don't know. But it's not worth thinking about since she's engaged to your ex-boyfriend.
My stomach tightens. I turn and focus on the moonlight playing across the waves, listen to the crash and roar. Seems louder than it does during the day.
I've always loved that.
He tips his head for me to follow him, and we make our way down the dune and to the left, out of the path of any foot traffic that may come up behind us. Then we sit and twist our cups into the sand. Miles pulls the checkered paper fry trays out and sets them atop the flattened bag. I catch him watching me as I take my first bite.
One, I say, mouth full.
One shoulder lifts in tandem with the corner of his mouth.
Just waiting to see if you moan again?
My face heats as I bite into a jalapeno. I don't know what you're talking about.
The sound you made when you tried the milkshake, he says. I want to know if the fries live up to that.
Honestly, I say, my mouth is on fire right now. He grabs my milkshake and lifts it toward me. I lean over the straw and take a slurp.
Better?
He asks. My teeth start chattering. He laughs and unzips his sweatshirt, taking it off and tossing it in my direction, less to me than at me. Thanks, I say, pulling it off my face and then wrapping it around my shoulders and bare back. The smell of the wood smoke from the winery's fireplace engulfs me.
Now I know where your smell comes from.
He balks.
I smell?
No, I say. I mean, I thought you smelled kind of like ginger snaps, but you just smell like the winery. It's nice. He leans into me to inhale against the fabric on my shoulder.
Guess I'm too used to it to notice.
I mean, a lot of times it's hiding under the smell of weed, I say. He looks at me askance, teasing.
Is that judgment, Daphne?
Merely an observation, I say. He leans back against the sand, propped up on his forearms.
I've been going a little harder than usual.
He eyes me through his lashes.
Not sure if you've heard, but I got dumped.
Sounds vaguely familiar, I concede.
I'm cutting back, he says.
At that precise moment, I bury my hands in the sweatshirt pockets and am met with a pre-rolled joint. I pull it out with a laugh.
I've been looking for that.
Miles plucks the joint from my fingers and pops it between his lips.
You got a light?
Sadly, no, I say.
No, I mean, you've got a light, he says. Other pocket.
Ah. I withdraw the neon orange plastic lighter and snap it open, blocking the wind until the flame catches. He leans in so I can light the end of the tiny joint. He takes a puff, then holds it out to me. I hesitate, and his mouth splits into a wide smile.
Whatever those DARE officers might have told you, I'm not going to force you. It's just an offer.
As a devoted fan of Control, I never had a big weed phase, but annoyingly, the voice in my head reminding me of that isn't my own. It's Peter's, and I don't want it there. It has no right to keep echoing through my skull. For 3 years, I've been eating like him, exercising like him, working tirelessly to befriend his friends and impress his family, going to his favorite breweries, and all along, I thought it was my idea, my life. Only now, without him in the picture, absolutely none of the rest of the picture makes sense. I'm not sure what parts of me are him and which parts are genuinely my own. And I want to know. I want to know myself, to test my edges and see where I stop and the rest of the world begins. So I pluck the joint from between Miles's finger and thumb and take a hefty pull on it, feeling the sensation spiral through me. When I pass it back to him, he takes one more hit, then stubs it out. Does this place have a name? I ask. Down by the nearest bonfire, a group in their late teens or early 20s are clinking their beer bottles and cans of hard seltzer together, howling up at the moon.
I don't know, he says. I've only ever heard people call it the spot.
The spot, I say, sounds exactly like where high schoolers come to smoke weed.
True, he says, but I haven't had any luck yet tracking down the stretch of beach where 30-somethings go to smoke weed.
Oh, they're all just vaping from their beds while watching HGTV.
Not us, he says.
No, we're adventurous, I say.
Okay, tell me something, Daphne.
He tips his face toward the stars. I lean back on my forearms. What? He looks over, the left half of his face shadowed.
Where do you go when you're not at home?
Like, other than work?
Other than work, he nods. Because despite your impressive commitment to the calendar, there actually are slots of time when you're unaccounted for, but I never see you out. And you'd never been to Cherry Hill, or Meat Locker, or here. So, where do you go?
Nowhere, I say. I'm boring.
You're not boring, he says. You're keeping secrets.
What Ashley said comes back to me, a closed book. There was a time when I was okay at making friends, but that was probably 4 or 5 relocations back. Eventually, it didn't seem worth it anymore, cracking myself open to let someone in, only to have them violently extracted months later when Mom got transferred again. Honestly, I say, if I'm not at home or work, I'm usually just reading somewhere else. The beach, the public beach, or the Lone Horse Cafe on Mortimer Avenue. And if I'm not reading, I'm probably working on some program or another. Lots of trips to Meijer and Dollar Tree. His eyes shrink to accommodate his spreading smile. You're thinking that all sounds pretty boring, aren't you? I say. He laughs. No, he says a little too vehemently. At the face I make, he relents.
Okay, a little bit. But just because that sounds boring to me doesn't mean I think you're boring.
Yeah, but you also held up your end of a 15-minute conversation with Craig about property taxes, so I think your social standards are exceptionally low.
He was a nice guy, Miles says.
I rest my case.
I like most people. Is that so bad?
It's not bad at all, I say. It's decidedly working in my favor. It just makes it hard for me to realistically gauge how big of a loser I am.
You're not a loser at all, he says, emphatic.
I roll my eyes. He sits up higher, his face earnest despite his visibly high pupils.
I'm serious. That asshole already took your house. Don't let him take your self-esteem.
It wasn't really my house, I say. It was in his name.
It was still your home, he says.
That word doesn't gut me quite so bad as usual. The weed is filtering pleasantly through me, and the night sky is gorgeous, and the air smells like furs and smoke and fresh water with that little snap of ginger. The truth feels more manageable. I want to manage it. That's what I'm realizing, though, I tell him, wrapping the sweatshirt more tightly around me. It wasn't ever my home. When you take Peter off the schedule, there isn't really much left. Waning Bay doesn't belong to me like it does to him.
I'll give him the house, Miles says, but he's not taking this town.
I cast a sidelong glance his way. You're just fine with knowing you could run into them at any point. Doesn't it bother you that you could be buying toilet paper and Alka-Seltzer and come face to face with Petra's parents? He shrugs.
That'd be fine.
He sits up.
Wait, are you thinking about leaving?
More like dreaming about it. I check the American Library Association job portal daily.
Would you go back to Richmond? Miles asks.
There's that little stab of pain that home didn't summon. It was my very first thought when the dust settled. I could go back to my old town, my old job, my old friendships. Then, a few days after the big showdown, I finally pulled myself from the pit of despair long enough to answer one of Sadie's phone calls. I'm so angry with Peter, I could honestly punch him in the face, she told me. She was apologetic, comforting, but then the unspoken became spoken. You both matter to us so much, we're not choosing sides. Like it was a basketball game. And she and Cooper had decided not to make posters or sit in a specific section of bleachers. Like things needed to play out, and then someone would simply have won, and someone else would have lost. I told her I'd never want her to choose sides. But honestly, I didn't want it to even feel like a choice. I wanted her to know where she stood. The problem was, she wasn't my best friend anymore. She and Cooper were our best friends. They were a unit, and we were another, and that was how we'd fit. I couldn't remember the last time we'd done something just the two of us. And in those days, when I was mourning in a puddle, Peter was doing damage control. So if our breakup wasn't a basketball game, maybe it was a race, and I was too slow. Sadie and I have barely spoken since that call. And I grieved that loss as much as, or more, than the end of my romantic relationship. Not Richmond, I tell Miles. That might feel even worse than being here, which was saying something. Maryland, hopefully. Miles does that Labrador-esque head tilt of his.
What's in Maryland?
My mom, I say.
You're really close,
he says, half observation, half question. I pull my knees into my chest and loop my arms around them. She and my dad split up when I was really young, so it's always been the two of us. Not in a sad way. She's the best. What about you? Are you close with your family? He scratches the back of his head and gazes out across the water.
My little sister, yeah. We text basically every day. She lives in Chicago.
And your parents? I ask.
An hour outside of Chicago.
He offers no more. It's the first time I've felt like there's something he'd rather not talk about. I feel the tiniest bit disappointed. He makes it so easy to open up. I wish I knew how to do the same.
Anyway, he says, I don't think you should move to Maryland.
I won't go until you find another roommate, I say.
It's not about that, he says. You moved here because of Peter. Don't let him make you move away, too.
So you're saying I should stay out of spite, I say.
I just think it would be shitty to uproot your whole life for this guy twice, he says.
Miles, I say. I just recounted what my whole life looks like, and I watched a piece of your soul die behind your eyes.
That's not what happened, he says.
It is, I say.
What about your job?
The ember in my chest flares. What about it?
You're constantly, like, teaching kids to make bird feeders and running costume contests. It clearly means a lot to you.
It does mean a lot to me, I allow. Sometimes when I'm running story hour, I literally remember partway through that I'm getting paid to do something I love, and it feels like I'm dreaming. Like I might wake up and realize I'm late for my shift at the dress barn. And there's this girl, Maya, who comes in once a week, 12 or 13, perfect little weirdo. She reads everything, goes through like 5 books a week. And we have an informal book club where I pick something out I think she'll like, and it goes in the stack, and then she comes back a week later, and we just talk about it for an hour while I'm doing admin stuff. She's super smart. Has a hard time at school, but you can just tell she's going to be some great novelist or like film director someday.
You love it,
Miles says. I love it, I admit. It's the piece of my life that still feels right, even with Peter excised from the picture.
Then don't give it up, Miles says. Not for him.
Of course, there are also days when I have to spend an hour on the phone with one of our regulars because he wants me to look up a love poem and spell every single word of it for him. I say,
why?
Miles says. Sometimes the job of a librarian is to simply not ask. Anyway, I'm keeping an eye out for job postings in other cities, but I can't leave for 85 days.
That is extremely specific, he says.
It's when the readathon happens, I explain.
Ah.
He flashes a teasing grin.
Readathon prep meeting, Tuesdays from 2 to 3 p.m.
Do you have a photographic memory? I ask.
Sure, he says. Also, it's been a standing appointment on your calendar since you moved in.
You've been reading it, I say, unable to hide my glee.
Of course I have. What's a readathon anyway?
A fundraiser, I say.
An all-night reading thing for the kids with contests and prizes and that kind of thing.
Basically, an event to fund other events because we don't have any money. Waning Bay's never done one, but I went to one as a kid and it was a lot of fun. I've basically been working on this since I got here. His brow lifts.
And it's at the end of summer?
Mid-August, I confirm. After a moment, he says,
okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to be your tour guide.
I'm not doing acid with you, Miles, I say.
Good to know, he replies, but not the kind of tour guide I'm talking about. I'm going to show you around Waning Bay. We can go out on Sundays when we both have work off, starting next week. And then, if by the end of July, you still want to go play Golden Girls with your mom.
Do you even realize how cozy Golden Girls is? I interject, reaching the giggly phase of being high. If I could move to the set of Golden Girls, I would.
That's what you say now, Miles says. But by the end of the summer, you're going to be head over fucking heels for this place, Daphne. Just wait and see.
Yeah, I say.
I'm serious, he says.
Oh, you're serious? I say. You're serious that you're going to spend all summer ferrying a near-perfect stranger around so that she won't move away?
You're not a stranger.
He knocks his leg into mine.
You're my serious, monogamous girlfriend, remember?
I chortle, the high seeming to explode through my veins from the force of it. His face remains deeply, painfully earnest.
I don't want you to move away. I like you.
You like everyone, I remind him. I'm a highly replaceable. He rolls his eyes.
You really think you have me figured out, don't you?
Am I wrong? I ask. He holds my gaze, not quite smiling.
We both flinch when his phone chimes in his pocket. He slides it out, his face lit as he reads the message on screen, a divot etched between his brows.
"Everything okay?" I ask.
His teeth worry at his lower lip.
"Petra."
"Seriously?" I say. "You two still talk?"
"Not often."
He scratches his jaw. I think about the tense call I overheard behind his bedroom door, wonder if it's possible he was talking to her and what Peter would make of that.
"Apparently Katya told her that we were together at Cherry Hill," he says.
I shift uncomfortably.
"And she messaged you about that?" "She's happy for us," he says,
voice quiet and flat. "Well, that's good," I say. "Petra's happiness has always been my utmost concern." He looks over at me, slowly starts to laugh. The weed has my heart feeling like softened butter, even while my stomach boils over with anger. At Petra and Peter both, not just on my behalf this time, but on Miles's too. This ridiculously nice man who let me move into his place, no questions asked, didn't even charge rent my first month, and comped my food tonight, and bought me a milkshake, and brought me to a beach I'd never been to, and lent me his jacket. Offered to parade me around all summer just so I won't move away. After hanging out twice. In general, I don't put too much stock into a person's charm, but I think he might be the rare real deal. A genuinely kind person who likes everyone and deserved better than a note on the counter and Petra's room-sized closet cleared out. I hold my hand out for his phone. He considers for a second, then plops it into my palm. "Come here," I say, opening the camera. His eyebrows pinch in a bemused expression.
"Come where?"
I move the remnants of our fries to my far side and pat the space between us.
"Oh, there," he says, "one foot to my left."
He doesn't ask why, just holds my gaze and scoots until his side's right up against me.
"Here."
My stomach flips at the closeness of his voice.
"That's good."
I hold his phone in front of us, the camera's flash turned on, and lean into him. He puts an arm around me and smiles sort of ruefully, unable to muster true joy. At the last second, on a whim, I turn and kiss his cheek as the picture finally snaps. His face turns toward mine, our noses almost touching, pieces of his chin and cheeks hidden behind the flash's afterglow.
"Just thought we could make Petra really happy," I say. "Really thoughtful of you,"
he says, the corners of his mouth curving.
"Yeah, well," I say. "I thought about taking a video of myself giving you a lap dance, but I don't have anything to mount your phone on, so this was the next best thing." "I will happily go back into the woods, find some sticks, and build you a tripod, Daphne," he says.
I laugh, busy myself with another sip of milkshake, immediately shivering from the icy cold.
"Here."
He draws me in against his chest so that we're almost fitted together like we're on a sled, him in back, me in front, and his arms folded around mine, blocking the worst of the wind. I shiver again as I nestle back against him, snapping a few more pictures. Honestly, my head is swimming from all these unfamiliar sensations, and I'm not sure whether I'm still taking pictures for any reason other than not quite wanting to acknowledge how good it feels to be curled up against him. It's been so long since I've been curled up against anyone.
"You don't have to do this, you know,"
he says. I lower the phone in front of me and glance over my shoulder at him. "I know that."
"You were probably right," he says. "They're probably not even jealous. And even if she was, so what? As it turns out, it doesn't make me feel any less like shit."
"It makes me feel less like shit," I say. His brow lifts skeptically.
"Does it?"
"Okay, not exactly," I admit. "But it makes me mad that she, like, thinks you need her approval to move on or something.
If she was so in love with Peter, she never should have strung you along like that, but she did, and she dumped you in the worst possible way. And then for her to just insist that you view her kindly, to try to make you not mad instead of just letting you move on, it's selfish. So maybe it's immature and stupid, but it does make me feel a little better to think that maybe she'll see these pictures and remember that even if she's not overall an asshole, she was the asshole in this scenario, and she didn't appreciate you, and she should have. Even if all that meant was letting you go before telling my boyfriend she was in love with him, instead of keeping you on the back burner in case Peter turned her down. It makes me feel a teensy, tiny bit better to think she could see a picture of me sitting in your lap and staring adoringly at you and remember that you deserved that all along. His smile unzips slowly from one side of his mouth. After a long moment, he leans forward and presses a kiss to my temple. "Thank you," he says, arms tightening around me. My body warms as if I'd cannonballed into a heated pool. "It's just the truth." I turn my eyes to the water, my blood humming with nervous energy. We're done taking pictures, but neither of us moves. It feels too good to be wrapped in someone's arms, protected from the wind and listening to the lake's easy rhythm, feeling Miles's breath move through him until mine sinks up without even trying. "This is nice," I say, sort of dreamily and entirely unintentionally. The few times I've smoked weed, this has always been the primary effect, a feeling that the cord between my brain and mouth has been snipped and I have no control over what I'm saying. Miles nods against the side of my head.
"It is,"
he agrees.
"Miles," I say.
"Hmm?"
I, and the weed, tell him, "I think you might be the nicest person I've ever met."
"I'm not being nice when I tell you not to move away," he says. "I like hanging out with you. And you're the best roommate I've ever had by a landslide."
"You mean I'm clean," I say.
"Learn to take a compliment," he says.
"See?"
I say.
"See what?"
he asks. I turn to look at him.
"Even when you try to be mean, you're nice."
His eyes seem to spark when he smiles.
"I'll try harder."
We go back to sitting there, touching, watching bonfires dance, and the water roll. 10. Saturday, June 1st. 77 days until I can leave. Miles and I pass the next week without so much as brushing shoulders in the kitchen. I don't think either of us is actively avoiding the other. It's more like we both suddenly remember we don't know each other and have nothing in common beyond our hilariously bad breakups. We're back in the territory of polite nods, separate dinners, and conversation made via monosyllable. When we got home, he made a big show of scribbling "Waning Bay Tourism" on the calendar, drawing an arrow down the Sunday column. But since then, he hasn't added anything else. By the time my Saturday morning shift rolls around, I'm convinced that his adamancy about showing me around was a byproduct of the joint we shared. I'm out the door before he's even up, the sun and birds out full force, though the air remains crisp. I'm early, as usual, so I decide to walk to work and even stop in at a whitewashed coffee shop overflowing with hanging plants to grab a hot chai. It's strange. I've driven this way dozens of times, but on foot, I notice new things. A Tudor house with a lush flower garden and a wooden sign advertising it as a Montessori school. A hobby shop called High Flyers, whose theme seems to be a mix of kites and THC. Then I turn down a residential street, reading the yard signs as I go. One about Bigfoot, another promoting an upcoming arts fair, then a crooked for sale sign in the shaggy, overgrown lawn of a taffy green bungalow. Its white picket fence is in disrepair, some slats entirely missing, and its diamond-paned windows are crawling with ivy.
It looks like something from a storybook, magical and cozy, yet somehow wild, mysterious in that irresistible way of fairy tale houses. At work, I help Harvey swap out the programming corkboard for the week. Waning Bay Public Library is a small enough operation that it's usually all hands on deck. You do whatever needs doing, regardless of job title. While pinning a flyer for Build Your Own Terrarium Night, Harvey says,
"You've been in brighter spirits this week."
He bears more than a passing resemblance to Morgan Freeman, and his voice, although raspier and not quite so low, has the same kind of gravitas. It's a voice that makes you want to do him proud. "Sorry," I say quickly. "I'll be better about not bringing all of that into work." Harvey harumphs, pushes his gold wireframe glasses up his nose.
"It's a library, Daphne. If you can't be a human here, where can you?"
At his kindness, I feel a sting of guilt about my job search, about knowing there's a technical services librarian position open in Oklahoma, a place I know nothing about that can't be learned from the musical Oklahoma.
"We're lucky to have you," Harvey goes on, hanging the sign-up sheet for Friday's Dungeons & Dragons tournament. "Just keep bringing your whole heart in for those kids. That's all."
The sting redoubles. Harvey pats the wall, then ambles back to the office, while I move on to dismantling the Origami Dinosaur Day display to make room for the Pride Month display. Afterward, I help Ashley finish the Juneteenth and Loving Day displays while she fills me in on her first real date with Craig, delivering each startling tidbit of information in a perfect monotone while I try not to pee myself from laughing. When they got to his house after dinner, he made her sit with him in the car for 20 unspeaking minutes while the Fish album he'd put on finished playing, then did the exact same thing after he drove her home. "I'm glad someone's enjoying this," she says, but I can tell she's enjoying telling it too. It's fun and a little thrilling, feeling like we're kind of, sort of, real friends now. When I get back to my desk, I field a few calls, after which I teach roughly 500 kids how to sign in to an online game for the 500th time. By then, it's the peak of my work week, Saturday Story Hour. Bonus, it's a warm, cloudless day, so we can take this activity outside. When we're settled in a ring in the grass out front, I ask, "Who's ready to hear a story?" Hands go up around the circle, shameless excitement, open expressions of feelings. It's funny. As a kid, I had no idea how to interact with other kids. I felt most at home with Mom and her friends. But as an adult, I find kids so much easier to understand. They say how they feel, and they show it, too. There are fewer ulterior motives and unwritten rules. Silences aren't unbearably awkward, and abrupt segues to different subjects are the norm. If you want to be friends with someone, you just ask, and if they don't want to, they'll probably just tell you. I clear my throat and open Snapsy the Alligator to get us started, scanning my rapt audience as I begin to read. Arham, of course, wears his trademark Spider-Man costume. A 3-year-old, Lila, has spaghetti sauce all over her face and dungarees. She's also sucking on a lemon wedge like it's a pacifier. Basically, all is right with the world. Halfway through our second story, I notice someone approaching from the parking lot, seemingly carried on a burst of summer air and sunshine. He's gazing at the covered breezeway to the front doors like he's never seen anything like it, possibly never seen a library, period. His eyes slice sideways toward us, and I lose my place in the sentence. Miles's face lights with a grin. He lifts his chin in greeting and draws to a stop just beyond our little ring. I clear my throat and glance down at the picture book in my hand, finding my place in the sentence to begin reading aloud again. When I next look up, he's still there, looking enraptured. By this story, about anthropomorphic mice, learning to do gymnastics. I wish I hadn't been quite so committed to doing voices for all of the characters before he showed up, because now I'm obliged to keep at it. So I use my high-pitched squeak for the littlest mouse's dialogue and my low grumble for the portly older mouse with the distinguished mustache. Every time I scan the crowd, Miles's smile is a little bigger, goofier. He keeps looking around at the kids, parents, and nannies like, "Can you believe this shit? Wild!" When I reach the end, the toddler's caregivers give the mild applause appropriate for a late-afternoon library trip, whereas Miles sticks his fingers in his mouth and whistles, which somehow instantly turns all 15 kids from sleepy angels into rowdy buccaneers, drunk on distilled below-decks rum. A couple of moms eye my scrubby, wolfish roommate curiously. He is blissfully unaware, ambling toward me through the crowd as the other patrons gather their diaper bags and sticky-handed children to pull them toward the parking lot.
"I had no idea you could do that," he says.
"Oh, yeah," I say, starting back toward the front doors. They whoosh open and we enter the cool, musty quiet. "I've been reading since I was 6. I'm getting pretty good."
"I mean the voices," he clarifies. "You're such a convincing elderly magician mouse."
"If that impressed you, you should see me do the old woman who lives in a shoe," I say.
"I'll clear my Saturdays," he says.
"I was kidding," I say. He grins.
"Not me."
I gesture toward the stacks. "Can I help you find something?"
"I was hoping you could spell out every word of a love poem to me."
He deadpans.
"That guy already called today,"
Ashley pipes up from the reference desk.
"Yeah, I've hit my limit on daily X-rated flower metaphors, so that's the one thing I can't help you with," I tell him.
He shrugs.
"I'll try again on Monday. Actually, I was on my way into Cherry Hill, and I just wanted to double check we're still on for tomorrow. Would have texted, but I forgot my phone at home."
"Tomorrow?"
Ashley looks up from the gel manicure she's giving herself, complete with a little light-up device plugged in between her computer and the printer. Harvey left already for his daughter's 40th birthday, and the front desk quickly descended into lawlessness.
"What's tomorrow?"
"I wasn't planning to hold you to that," I tell Miles. He scoffs.
"It's on the calendar. It might as well be etched into the annals of history."
"It's pronounced anals," Ashley says.
Miles looks to me, brow lifting. I shake my head. "It's definitely not, and you really don't have to ferry me around. I can just, like, buy a map." He rolls his eyes, slumps forward on his forearms at the desk.
"Just be ready at 1 p.m., okay?"
"Okay," I say. He looks between me and Ashley.
"Should I expect you at Cherry Hill tonight?"
"I've got readathon stuff I need to work on," I say.
"And my kid's having friends over to play video games," Ashley says. "So I'll be shoveling pizza rolls in and out of the oven until dawn. But he's at his dad's again next Sunday night, if you guys want to do something then."
"Should we expect Craig, too?"
Miles teases, leaning across the desk, vaguely flirtatiously. Ashley shudders.
No, we should not. Daphne can fill you in on that. I can't bring myself to utter it aloud again.
He had too much fish, I explain.
Like an aquarium?
Miles says. Like posters upon posters of fish. The band, I say.
What's wrong with fish? He wants to know.
Nothing in moderation,
Ashley volunteers. But he also had commemorative mugs and action figures and cardboard cutouts. And I want to say sheets?
Hand towels, she corrects me. I don't begrudge a man a hobby, but if you're 40 and your apartment has a theme, I just don't see it working out for us.
Well, shit, Miles says. That rules out pretty much everyone I know.
I've seen your place, Ashley says. I didn't see a cohesive theme, unless it was major depressive episode.
When did you see my room?
Miles asks.
I picked Daphne up there,
she says, apparently happy to admit to her snooping.
Actually, the theme is you're never invited over again, I tell Ashley.
Then to Miles, what time do you need to get into work?
Shit.
He pitches himself forward over the desk to check the time on my computer.
His eyes flash back to mine, and he points for good measure, which really accentuates the Popeye-style anchor tattoo on his bicep.
Tomorrow, 1 o'clock. Don't be late.
I never am, I say. Miles is 15 minutes late. I tell him this when he enters the apartment.
I know, he says. Sorry, I went to get coffee and the line was really long.
He holds out a paper cup to me. I recognize the stamp on it as being from Fika, the shop I stopped into on my way to work yesterday. Thank you, I say. He doesn't answer, just waits expectantly for me to take a sip, I guess. I don't really drink coffee, I say. Unless I'm super tired, it makes me too jittery. His brow furrows, his lips knitting together.
You had one of their cups on your desk yesterday, so I assumed...
Chai, I say. He taps his temple like he's nailing the information to his head. Should we go? I ask. Outside our building, the sudden daylight briefly scalds my retinas. I lose all sense of direction, somehow running directly into Miles when he was just beside me. He catches my upper arms and turns me toward his truck, half a block up the street. So where are we going? I ask.
Shopping.
Really? I turn toward him, the wind whipping my hair across my face. I catch a fistful and push it out of my eyes, pinning it to my forehead. Are we doing a makeover montage? He looks down at himself.
Are you trying to tell me something here?
I mean, when you showed up at story hour yesterday, I caught Mrs. DeKuyper looking between you and a big bad wolf picture book like she was trying to spot the difference. Yeah, right, he says. She thought I was hot. You don't even know which one Mrs. DeKuyper was, I point out.
They all thought I was hot, he says. Women of a certain age love me.
You must remind them of when they were young, I say. And Abraham Lincoln was people's sexiest man alive. He unlocks the passenger door of his truck and hauls it open with one hand while he scratches his bearded jaw with the other.
You think I should shave it?
I think you should do whatever you want. I climb on to the ripped seat.
But you think the beard is bad?
He closes the door, the window rolled down between us. I think the beard is sheer chaos, I say, but not inherently bad. It's your face, Miles. All that matters is how you feel about it. He sets his forearms atop the door.
Well, Daphne, I'm less sure how I feel about it since that snarky big bad wolf comment.
Don't take my opinion too seriously, I say. You already know I have terrible taste in men. And honestly, the beard's growing on me. Chaos suits him. Where are we going shopping? Family fair?
Better.
He pushes the lock down, then rounds the truck and gets in. Tom's Food Market? I say.
Better,
he repeats. Oh, I know, I cry. Meyer! He looks over, the engine starting with a sputtering cough.
Do me a favor, he says lightly, and unlock your door.
Why?
So I can push you out as I peel out of this parking lot, he says.
You would never, I say.
I would never, he admits, and pulls onto the road.
He turns us away from town and the water toward the countryside. His heartbreak playlist is still in full effect. Or maybe he's just put it back on to amuse me, because he does seem a little more smirky than usual. The traffic thins as we drive inland, away from the quaint downtown and the cotton candy-colored Victorian and colonial revival-style resorts that line the beach. It's easy to forget how secluded Waning Bay really is when you're inside of it, but within minutes, we're winding into gloriously sunlit farmland. Then, out of nowhere, we're pulling to the side of the road. Through the dusty windshield, I spot a green-painted farm stand on the shoulder, behind which two older ladies in work pants, floral tank tops, and matching visors are hawking asparagus. So, to be clear, I say, when you said shopping, you meant for asparagus. Miles gives me a mildly offended look.
This, he says, is just phase one.
I hop out, dirt kicking up under my sandals, and follow him to the stand.
Well, hello there, one of the ladies calls. Back already?
Of course, Miles says. Barb, Lenore, this is my friend Daphne Vincent. Daphne, this is Barb Sato and Lenore Pappas.
Nice to meet you, I say.
Daphne's newish to town, Miles goes on, and she's never had your asparagus before.
Is that so?
The smaller of the two women, Barb, perks up. She starts rustling through the crates.
Let me find you the best of the best.
I'm sure there's no bad stock to be had, I say.
No, of course not,
the other woman, a head taller than the first, says.
But Barb does have a knack for picking the best, and we want our first-timers to come back, so let her work her magic.
I appreciate it, I say. Lenore leans across the table.
How have you been holding up, honey?
Good, Miles says. I'm good.
She squeezes his forearm.
You're a good boy, and you deserve to be happy. Don't you forget that. These are the ones for you.
Barb lifts a bundle of asparagus that must contain at least 27 stalks.
Oh, yeah, those look good,
Miles agrees, holding open the tote bag he brought from the truck. She drops the asparagus in, and he slides his wallet from his pocket.
No, Barb says. Your money's no good here.
He shoves the 10 in his hand into their tip jar to much protestation.
It would be a crime not to pay for this.
Theft, technically, I put in.
You take care of our boy,
Lenore tells me sternly, but with a wink.
He's one of the good ones.
I've been picking up on that, I say. They coo and fawn over him as we wave our farewells and trek back to the dirt-smeared truck, my cheeks aching from subconsciously matching their sunny smiles. As soon as we're in the car and out of earshot, I drop my voice to a murmur.
You weren't kidding about that beard's effect on our honored elders.
He laughs.
No, they hate the beard. They just like me because I spend a fuck ton on their asparagus and their corn later in the season.
A guffaw rises out of me as we glide back onto the road.
Miles, I'm pretty sure they would have given you their entire surplus and everything in the tip jar. How much corn can one man possibly eat to earn that kind of adoration?
It's not one man, he says.
Damn, I say. A modern Walt Whitman.
No, I mean, we source from them.
We? I ask.
Cherry Hill, he says.
At my blank response, his eyes dart to the road, then to my face, and back a couple more times.
I'm their buyer.
What does that mean? I say.
It means our chef, Martine, makes a few different menus every season, and I get the best stuff I can find for him. So I go to the butcher, and the farm stands, and the olive oil store, and the cheesemonger.
Cheesemonger? I say. You have a cheesemonger on speed dial?
Since it's not 1998, he says. No, I don't have her on speed dial, but we text whenever she's got something special in.
Wow, I say. Who knew I was moving in with the most well-connected man this side of Lake Michigan?
Probably everyone that I'm connected to, he replies. So, like, half of Waning Bay?
So if I was in need of, like, strawberry preserves.
Ready Family Farm, he says. But if they are low, Drake is good too.
And if I wanted butternut squash, I say.
Faith Hill Sustainable Farms, he says. I open my mouth and he adds, no connection to the country singer, sadly.
I frown. Too bad. I know, he says.
What about if I needed green beans? I ask.
Ted Ganji's Green Bean Farm,
he says.
And if I needed to take out a hit on someone, I say.
Gil from Meat Locker.
He answers, not missing a beat. At the look on my face, a laugh rockets out of him.
It's a joke, Daphne. But Gil did mention he was looking for homes for a litter of kittens.
I'm not sure the Cherry Hill clientele is quite that culinarily adventurous, I say.
And lucky for them, Chef Martine isn't either. I have been thinking about getting a cat, though, he says.
One more reason I should move to Maryland. I say. I'm allergic.
The cat's out, he says.
Don't give up your hypothetical cat for me, Miles, I say. Barb and Lenore will actually kill me if I rob you of that joy.
The cat was just a pipe dream, he says. After an infancy with Gil, there's no way I'll be able to give one of those kittens the life it's accustomed to.
True. You don't own enough leather or have a motorcycle with a tiny sidecar and helmet.
Oh my God, that would be so fucking cute,
he says, delight lighting up his deep brown eyes. He puts on his blinker as we approach a cherry stand. It's essentially a repeat of our stop at the asparagus stand, except that Barb and Lenore are replaced by Robert Sr., a portly guy in his 40s, and Rob Jr., a gangly kid who's anywhere between 11 and 22. This time, I insist on paying for the two bags of cherries, and when we climb back into the cab of the truck, Miles looks at me expectantly, his seatbelt still undone and the engine off.
Aren't you going to try one?
Is this some kind of kink for you? I say. A blush hits the tops of his cheekbones, the only part not hidden by his werewolf beard.
I just want to know if you think they're as good as I do.
Okay, okay. I dig around for two plump, long-stemmed cherries and hand him one. As if there's some invisible countdown, we hold eye contact and pop the cherries in our mouths at the same second. It's sweet without being overpowering. Tart without giving that biting down on metal sensation. And juicy. Juicier than any cherry I've ever bought in a store. So juicy that when I bite into it, sticky pink sluices out between my lips and drips down my chin. And even though not 2 seconds ago I had been determined not to make a sound, an enthusiastic mm-mm rolls through me, followed by a wow. Grinning, Miles grabs a big Louis-branded napkin from the center console and mops up my chin before I can get cherry juice everywhere. He crumples the napkin into an empty paper cup in the cup holder, then spits out the pit from his cherry and holds the cup up for me to do the same. A strangely intimate gesture that makes my insides feel like they've been baking in the sun just a few minutes too long and will char if they're not turned over soon.
Best cherry you've ever had, Miles guesses.
Honestly, I didn't even know I liked cherries until right now, I say.
He says, they weren't my thing either until I moved here.
Where are you from again? I ask. Sorry, I forget. His eyes flash away from mine.
No, that's okay.
He starts the car.
I'm from Illinois.
And how'd you end up out here? I ask. He looks over his shoulder before merging onto the road.
Followed a girl.
Petra? I say. He shakes his head.
Ooh, the other girlfriend, I say.
Number one of two, he confirms. Danny. She's actually Chef Martin's cousin. He and his husband started Cherry Hill, and he offered Danny a job in the tasting room, so she got me one too, and we moved from Chicago. Broke up a few months later. By then, I didn't want to leave, and she did, so she moved back to the city.
So that's why you don't think I should leave? I guess. Because of the 1% chance that Petra and Peter will decide to go first?
I told you, he says. I don't think you should leave because I don't want you to leave. And my happiness is very important. You heard Barb and Lenore.
I did, I say. I remember that lyric from the second stanza of the ballad they sang about you.
That was nothing, he says. Wait until you